Welcome to Energy Stew. This is Peter Roth, your host, and we're going to talk about your passion. Not just any old passion, the big passions, the ones that you long for and work hard for and make your life so satisfying. And to help us do that, to help you find your passion and understand it and how to live it and work with it and make it work, is our guest who's written a book called The Connection. That's the connection to your passion. And our guest is Anthony Szilard. And let's call him Tony. Tony, I know
that's
you're...
That's fine. Yeah, that's, you can call me Tony.
I know.
How's it going, Peter?
I know. Everybody calls you Tony, so I thought I would.
that's perfect. I appreciate it.
Good. So I love the book. It's very helpful. And it, everybody who reads it is going to be inspired by it. You make you give people an opportunity to discover themselves and understand themselves in a better way that makes it easier to live for your passion. How do you respond to that?
Well, thanks, Peter. You know, it's interesting because I've always felt that what I learned in school and what I grew up sort of accepting as truth really didn't work for me, and I tried to look into a lot of different themes, and passion was a big one, because I think there's this, I think actually if we ask your listeners, for example, if they agree with this statement, you know, to discover your passion, identify what makes you happy and start doing it. I think probably most people would say that's true. Discover your passion, identify what makes you happy, and start doing it. And that's what I believed. And what I found is actually that's a myth. It's actually the opposite. It's that passion comes from suffering. You know, and it's interesting because actually the word passion comes from the Latin verb patire, P-A-T-I-R-E, which means to suffer. You know, we see this all over. We see this in Christianity. You have the passion of Christ, the crucifixion, suffering of Christ. You see, example I think about a lot is a woman who I coached for a number of years who, I do a lot of personal life coaching and leadership coaching. And I noticed that she, you know, she really wasn't happy in what she was doing in her career. And so I helped her to understand, like, well, what had she gone through growing up, and what had really caused her suffering? And she recognized that she grew up nurturing her father as he was dying from an incurable cancer, and you know, her and her mother spending so many years taking care of her father before he passed away, and she completely changed careers, and now she's the director of a major hospital. She's, you know, helping and leading a team of doctors to find cures to cancer and other diseases, and I think that's very common that what's caused us pain is the genesis of change.
And yet we can have pain through watching others, and we can have pain through our own suffering. And that's true, and I've noticed that in so many areas of health and wellness that people don't try to get better until they need to.
Well, that's right. And it's interesting that compassion, you know, the good news is it doesn't have to be your own suffering. That's the good news. You know, compassion comes from com in Latin, which is with, and patire, passion, suffering, which doesn't mean to suffer with, because when we suffer with someone, we reduce our capacity to help them. Because we end up getting pulled down and go into our own depression. But compassion means to be with someone in their suffering. And I think that a lot of people that I've seen have really gotten their passion from observing the suffering of others. You know, I know myself, you know, I was in the Peace Corps in Kenya, and I remember being in this village and just seeing, like, this is just not right. I mean, there's seeing all these kids without access to even textbooks or any kind of, you know, I was a teacher, and seeing the schools where you had like two classes sharing the same classroom with a bamboo partition dividing them, 60 kids on each side, sitting on the ground on a dirt floor, getting insects and welts in their legs, and the teachers are shouting at each other, like, you're teaching too loud, the kids on my side can't hear me. And, you know, that really, you know, gave rise to, I ended up starting a nonprofit to doing work over in Kenya, Tanzania, Guatemala, Indonesia, raised about $15 million for it. That's how I got started in leadership and really in the nonprofit side. And a lot of what I do now, it's interesting because a lot of people will look at me and they say, wow, you know, you're doing all this leadership coaching. You're coaching Fortune 500 companies like Disney, Nokia, IBM. You know, I'm very fortunate to be married to someone I love deeply and I enjoy my home life too and able to find that balance. A lot of people say, wow, you know, you have so much going for you. And I say, well, you know, if you only could see where this has come from, because you know, I can guarantee you, Peter, I really would have taken the wrong turn had I not been able to identify that suffering I've been through, which for me was physical abuse from a stepfather. You know, I grew up with, you know, feeling like it wasn't safe to come home. You know, when a man who's not your father beats you up and sleeps with your mother, you don't feel like much of a person, and that's how I felt growing up. And now a lot of people would take that pain and let it convert naturally into anger, which is what pain does when it sort of sits, you know. And then anger over time becomes, you know, when it's stored, it becomes resentment, which is, you know, sentire, to feel. It's to feel anger again and again and again, and it paralyzes us. And that's exactly what happened to me for a number of years. I got into a lot of negative activities, and then at a certain point, I think just before I went into the Peace Corps, I was about 23, I realized, like, I had to turn my life around. And then I was able to realize that this what I had been through was actually, you know, I could actually be grateful for it. Because of that physical abuse, that's why my passion now, because of that feeling of powerlessness, that suffering in me, I now wake up every day wanting to help others feel powerful. It's like I would do this even if I wasn't paid to do it. It's just what I love to do. I feel like each person has the right to access the power that's there in their lives if they're just willing to see it. And that's what kind of, you know, that's what really motivates me. And I think what, you know, for your listeners, I would encourage you to say, well, you know, what about the world? What about your community, the country, the world just makes you uncomfortable? It makes you say, this is not the way it should be.
Or your own life. I mean,
exactly. It could be in your own life.
Sure.
Thank you. Yeah, it could be in your own life, or it could be outside of you. But either way, that's where you can then figure out, well, this is what I really want to do. And you see so many cases where people are sitting around now, kind of whining about the economy, and oh, you know, I'm not making as much money as I used to. I don't have this. You know, my power is dwindling, and that's just, it's all about what we receive. You know, when people focus so much, say, okay, I'm not getting the money, the status, the promotion I used to get, and they lose their power, because power is not in what we receive, it's in what we give, because we have actually some control over that. You know, we have zero control over what we receive, but we have 100% control over what we give. And we focus on, okay, well, how do I want to contribute? How do I want to help people? And again, it emanates from that suffering we've experienced.
Right, and so a lot of passion sometimes is just to avoid any of the previous suffering and to do a better job. And a lot of it is inspiring to help the planet and help others. And we can do both at the same time.
Well, absolutely. I mean, a good example of passion that's just trying to avoid what's happened before is, you know, think back on your life and think back to, you know, when you had a difficult breakup. You know, that's a time where you say, oh my God, I do not want to feel this way again. You know, I feel like a truck just ran over me and then reversed to see what happened. You know, and you just say, I don't want to go through something like this again. And so you change and you say, well, what kind of partner am I looking for here? What does intimacy really mean to me? And what does commitment mean to me? And that's how we grow. And if we don't experience that, you know, if you go out with someone and you really don't have that much feeling for them, you know, you can break up and be dating someone else a week later. You don't care.
Well, one thing about what you're talking about is that you were able to put it into a book that gives people step by step on how to find these issues in our lives, how to identify what we're unhappy about, and to then build our passion from realizing what we want to change.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think that a lot of this, a lot of what the connection is about, it's really about taking an inner detour and saying, you know, what really motivates me, what's important to me. And I think there's no better time than now to do that with everything that's going on in the world. It's like we have to come together, and people have to say, well, you know, how can I find meaning in my life and do something meaningful for myself and others? And I think especially when you're seeing a nation that's seeing its global power diminish, as the United States is experiencing right now, you know, a lot of people get depressed. They get well, just why is this happening, and what's come, you know, like all the sort of global events taking place, you know, with rising power in Europe and China, and say, gosh, you know, and we don't, you know, a lot of our jobs are being outsourced, and that's all. It's this sort of like, what's in it for me thinking. And that always takes us in the wrong direction. But when we can say, well, what can I contribute? What's, you know, I mean, I'll give you some examples. You know, I do coaching with a lot of companies too, and the companies that are doing well in this economy or any economy, they're just so focused on how they can contribute to their customer, and they notice the changing and evolving needs of their customers. It's like Hyundai Motors, you know, a few years ago when the economy started to go down, said, well, okay, I'll tell you what, if you buy a new Hyundai car and you get laid off within a year, you can return it, no questions asked. So it's kind of like a company saying, well, what are the evolving needs of my customer? And it's the same thing with we as human beings when we're trying to find our relevance, find our meaning and what we're, you know, how we want to make an impact in the world. You know, nothing has changed. We still have this 100% power to give, to contribute, and find a way to help others, basically.
Right, and what I like about your approach in the book is that it's step by step. What you're saying, you know, these are large understandings about the world and the politics and the economy, and there's only so much that we can do in a grander way from where we're starting from. And what I like about reading your book is that it says, okay, let's find the next thing that you can do. And let's find the next thing instead of saving the world all at once.
Well, yeah, exactly, Peter, because what happens for a lot of people is that you start getting stuck in these ideals and we're in this sort of dream state, but nothing really happens. And that's why I developed this sort of concept in the connection that you have, you know, the visionary is the part of you who develops a vision for your life. What you want to be remembered for, what you want to accomplish, how you want to treat others. And then what I call the actionary takes that vision and implements it.
Right.
And there's, you know, there's this guiding quote in there, which is, a goal is a dream with a deadline. And I think that's really the model in the book, is that you can, everything we've been talking about, these kind of lofty ideals, you know, if you don't make them happen, it's kind of like, you know, like Freud once said, you know, he who does not act on his he does not believe who does not act on his belief. You know, so if you don't take these ideals and do something with them, pretty much take them with you to the grave.
Right. Now you said, you know, a goal is an action with a deadline. But what do you say a vision?
A dream with a deadline.
Okay. What do you say a vision is?
Well, I think a vision is, it's like a statement of your core values. It's like projecting yourself, like imagining yourself at 80 years old, looking back at you sitting here right now talking with me. That 80-year-old Peter, what's he saying about the way you're living your life, about the choices that you're making?
So it's principles.
That's your higher self. That's your vision. You know, yeah. This is going to sound a little bit crazy, but this is honest truth. I sometimes will go for a walk, and I'll go out to Great. I live in Washington D.C., so I'll go out to Great Falls in Maryland or Virginia, and it's in both. It borders the Potomac River, and I'll go out there and just go for a walk, and I'll imagine that Tony with gray hair at 80 years old is walking next to me. And when I have critical decisions to make in my life, I ask him, like, what should I do? You know, that led me to my wife, because, you know, I was, you know, dating different people and having a kind of some craziness in my life, and this 80-year-old man was saying, hey, look, I'm gonna have to live with whoever you choose.
I love that.
And then, you know, so really, you know, are you really looking at these sort of superficial qualities, or are you gonna connect with what's inside of people? and really, you know, really look for someone that's gonna be sort of a nurturing soulmate, and someone that you can nurture. It's like I often when I'm coaching people, I often say, for example, you know, it's not what he drives, but what drives him. You know, when you're looking for, or it's not what she drives, it's what drives her. It's really the inner motivations. And I think part of what the connection is about is that when we connect with our own deepest passion, and we connect with what's inside of ourselves, it also enables us to connect with others, and on a deeper level, really connecting on the internal.
Right. So
that's where, you know, you think about it when we're, you know, when we don't have, I mean, I love this cartoon where you've got this guy lying in bed on his deathbed, and he's got one of his children sitting there by the side of the bed, and he's saying, "I wish I bought more crap." I mean, what are we going to really remember in our final days? And it's going to be the love we shared with people, the way we connected with people. That's all we're going to remember. All the things, all the, you know, our iPhones and iPads and computers and all the other things that we sort of work so hard to attain are going to mean nothing to us.
Well, I think it's how we made a difference in people's lives, and in our own life too. And yet, you know, it's great to look at ourselves when we're 80 and imagine what advice we could give ourselves. Right now, I am thinking back on decades of my being kind of lost in the world, but every time taking a step forward, being myself and succeeding. And yet, I didn't have this clear vision, or even these action goals, so much as being driven just by my desire to be of help in any way I could, and it got me here, where I'm a senior citizen, and it got me to a place in my life where I look back and I go, it worked, but I didn't have your book, and I think it's so helpful to be able to establish your vision statements and to learn, you know, to evolve what you want to be in life and what your principles are.
Well, it sounds like you've along the way had a lot of self-trust, Peter. Like you've trusted your desire. And you've been, you know, whatever, you know, with or without my book, you've been able to see what's really important to you and follow it. And I think what happens with a lot of people, actually the psychologist from 1940s, 50s, Karen Horney, she put this really well, and she made the distinction between a desire and a drive. And it's kind of a Freudian psychologist. And I find it useful because I think what you see in the connection is you see I'm attempting to get the reader to connect with their desire, with what is their desire for how they want to live their life, what they want to be remembered for, how they want to treat others, what's most important to them. And I think what Karen Horney then identifies as a drive, it's kind of like this sort of instinctual emotions that will push you in another direction. You know, and I think we see this a lot where someone can have a desire to be a really decent, kind, caring person. But then, you know, they get into the office, and then there's this drive which says, oh, I'm feeling insecure because others are, how are they looking at me? And I'm feeling fear because are people going to respect my position? And so on and so forth. Next thing you know, they're really not very nice people to be around. And they'd end up not really moving toward their vision, toward that desire. So it's kind of, I think each one of us can acknowledge this internal conflict we have. And say, well, there's this, you know, there's this desire, there's this larger ideal, and you know, but the ideal is always above the real. The real is always going to be compromised by this drive sometimes, which will, you know, for example, you know, I try to stop work by six and go and have a life and be with my wife, my friends, and go for a walk, watch the sunset, do things that I really enjoy, and then, you know, there's always comes along this day where I get on my computer, and all of a sudden it's like, you know, actually my wife is Mexican, and she went to Mexico just yesterday. And so what do I do? It's like my first day on my own in a number of months. Well, that drive just comes right in, and there I am on the computer till 11 at night. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, why did I do that? You know, you wake up going, what am I doing? You know, right. And I think we just have to be aware. There's this kind of like, you know, there's these many this sort of this drive that can often pull us in the wrong direction, and we have to acknowledge it, and then check in with ourselves and say, what is that desire? What is the vision? And okay, let's start moving toward it.
And it's great.
Actually, an Indian guru who I've read for a long time, who his name is Vivekananda, Swami Vivekananda, and he was the first Hindu to bring, actually the first Indian to bring Hinduism to the West in 1893 at the Chicago Council of World Religions, and he once said this thing which I love, which is that you extend from the center and return to the center. And I think if we can acknowledge, okay, where am I right now? Am I at the center? Am I aligned with my vision right now? Or, like me at 10 o'clock last night, you know what, I'm extended pretty far from my center. I don't need to be sitting here on my computer at 10 o'clock at night. And, you know, and then say, okay, let me shut this thing off, and what is important? You know, maybe go walk around the block and kind of refresh my mind and a little bit, and say, okay, well, what's, you know, what do I really value here?
Well, it's very important, of course, to have alone time to see yourself in perspective. And at the same time, it's wonderful that people in your life who help condition you to,
that's right,
to make better choices.
Well, you know, it's very true. And I think there's sometimes a tendency to think we can do it all on our own. And it's really not possible. And I mean, it's also... I think what we're experiencing now, and this is another one of the, I'm kind of a conspiracy theorist looking for a conspiracy. You may have read through the lines in that, in the connection, and sensed that. And I'm always looking for, what are the beliefs we've subscribed to that have moved us in the wrong direction? You know, and another one that I think, which I call the myth of the internet and social media, kind of related to my night last night, is this belief that I think most of us hold, which is, never in human history have we been connected with so many people. Like all of, you know, your listeners just asking, do you believe that's true? Never in human history have we been connected with so many people. I think most people believe that to be true.
Of course.
Well, what I believe is the truth is, from what I've observed, is never in human history have we been in contact with so many people and connected with so few.
That's true. They're both true, because it's how you define the connection, and obviously you're defining it in more meaningful terms.
Well, you know, exactly. I mean, and actually we can look and see, you know, for example, time with others, like you said, that helps to condition us. Let's look at what, you know, some of these studies out there, and a very, very interesting quote from Sheryl Sandberg, the chief operating officer of Facebook. She wrote in The Economist, The World in 2012 issue, she wrote, "The science fiction writers of the last century envisioned a world where modernity led to alienation. In fact, the opposite has occurred." Now, the interesting thing is that there were two sociological studies, one from Cornell University, the other from the University of Chicago, where they asked people every year since 1972, and among other things, they ask, how many close friends do you have? And a close friend is defined as someone with whom you can discuss important matters. Can you believe, Peter, that before the advent of the internet and social media, 1985, the average response was out of, you know, this is thousands of people responding, uh-huh, was three close friends. Two decades later, in 2004, the average response was two.
Wow.
So we're talking like over 30% loss in two decades, and this is pretty scary. I mean, in fact, the number of respondents who said they had zero close friends, no one with whom they could confide in, more than doubled to 25% of them by 2004. So that's I think kind of a call to action, that we need to connect with people. And if you think about it, if each one of your listeners were to say, I would ask you this question. Those of you listening out there, what have you done over the last few weeks that's made you the happiest? You know, take a moment to think about that. What have you done over the last few weeks that's brought the most happiness to your life? Now, I'm willing to bet the things that you're thinking about are like, well, time with my kids, time with my friends, I went for this long hike. I traveled to here and did this. And I bet that most of these things are, if not all of them, one, are offline. They're not connected to your computers. And two, they're involving a connection with, a deeper connection with yourself or with the people you care about.
That's
and
right.
That's becoming like an endangered activity at risk of extinction in today's society.
Right. My mind went right to the quality time I've had with my wife in the last 2 weeks. So
excellent. I mean, there's nothing so beautiful as that. And that's the thing. We have to really make time for that. And I think for a lot of people who are kind of stuck in the rat race of, and sort of the, you know, the hamster wheel of trying to get ahead and worried about work and are they going to, you know, there's this fear, am I going to be able to make ends meet and what's going to happen if I lose my job and so on. You know, we end up becoming workaholics and we're just round the clock working and trying to expand our networks and the people that we really care about, it's kind of like we have this, you know, it's kind of like we have this hidden dialogue with them, which is imagine writing a letter to your mother or your wife or someone, you know, really close to you saying, hey, you know, thanks for always being there for me. Because I'm so grateful for that, I'm going to ignore you and I'm going to instead pay all my attention, and allocate all my attention to the people I fear losing in my life and to my job, which I fear losing. And I'm going to, you know, pretty much take you for granted. That's what a lot of us do.
Yeah, and so the idea is to keep to our vision statements. I'm coming back to the book because we only have a couple of minutes left. And
sure.
I'm really impressed with the book, and I do want to promote it because I think it's so helpful for people to start writing down what's important and then having that perspective as a conditioning element. And then building action, and it's one step at a time action. I like the, you know, you're a former baseball player, or maybe you still are, and it's all about whether you want to hit singles or home runs. And if you hit home runs, you're going to get a lot of strikeouts. And maybe we should start off hitting singles.
Well, that's absolutely right, Peter. And you know, one of the key analogies, and there's a chapter on risk in there, which I think you're alluding to, about developing your capacity for risk. And
right.
One of the whole idea there that you know, that you either aim for the home run, and I don't know how many people know this, but you know, the season where Babe Ruth set the record for home runs, you know, the famous 60 home runs, that was back in the 20s.
He also
set the record for strikeouts.
Exactly.
All the home run kings, they all also lead the league in strikeouts.
Right.
And it's kind of like we have to make a decision. I'm sorry, you wanted to say something, Peter.
Yeah, no, I just wanted, because we're running out of time, and I liked what you said in the book about not to risk is a risk.
That's right, exactly. And you know, risk is the converse of itself. Like when you don't risk, that's a risk. And I think, you know, when you think about it, I wonder if you look back on your life, Peter, I can certainly tell you from mine that all the greatest things I've ever done that for me in my mind are the greatest, for me in my mind are the most meaningful, involved a lot of risk. You know, going off to, I mean, I was petrified. I might go live in Africa in a village for a few years by myself.
Sure. No, you're a very brave guy. I you know, from reading the book, I can see that. And you know, you're inspired by your history. And your childhood was a very difficult one. And so you've really, you know, climbed into your heart and into your passion and into finding really strong direction in your life. And that's what's inspiring. And that's why, you know, I'm so glad that you could be a guest on the show.
Well, I really enjoy it, Peter. And thank you for having me on your show. And I really appreciate also as a host that I can see, you know, you really have read the book and you know, you've taken something from it, and that's also very meaningful for me, so thank you.
Oh, sure, my pleasure. So, Anthony Szilard, thank you so much for being a guest on Energy Stew, and I'm really grateful that we could talk today.
Me too. Thank you, Peter.
Right. And the book is called The Connection, and this is Peter Roth, your host of Energy Stew at ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. I can be reached at peter@heartriver.org, my website, heartriver.org, part of the Heart River Center for Intuitive Healing. We have programs. Look on the website. And I can be reached at 212-222-7748. And thank you so much for listening.